From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, gang wars in cyberspace. We talk with journalists Michelle Slatala and Joshua Quittner about two rival gangs of computer hackers, the Legion of Doom and Masters of Deception. The same skills that enabled them to break into corporate computer systems enabled each gang to wreak havoc on the other. Later, we'll hear from one of the Masters of Deception who was convicted of computer crime and did time in prison. And world music critic Milo Miles reviews the latest release by Bob Amal from Senegal, who is currently on an American tour. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The judge in the O.J. Simpson case is deciding whether to delay opening statements by 1 week. The prosecution is asking for the delay because the defense has introduced a last-minute list of potential witnesses. Judge Ito has ruled the defense can talk about 10 of the witnesses in opening statements, but he says they can't use the remaining 24 witnesses until the prosecution checks them out. Meanwhile, Simpson has asked Judge Ito if he can personally speak to the jurors in opening statements. Ito has not ruled on that request. The Justice Department has filed suit against three states for failing to carry out the Motor Voter Act. The law is intended to make voting registration easier for citizens. UPI's Pi Chamberlain prepared this report.
Attorney General Reno said she sued California, Illinois, and Pennsylvania for refusing to implement the law passed last year. She said the law is simple and just tells states to
provide forms at a motor vehicle office, hand them out at other state social service agencies, and let people register to vote through the mail.
State officials say the law is expensive to carry out. California says it will cost $50 million a year. But most states have begun to implement the law, and voter registration is up over last year. Republicans fought the law in Congress, saying it would register more Democrats than Republicans. Pi Chamberlain, Washington.
President Clinton has signed into law a bill making Congress obey the same workplace laws as the rest of the country. The Congressional Accountability Act is the first bill to be passed by the Republican-controlled Congress. It extends 11 labor laws to Capitol Hill. The Supreme Court has made it a little easier for death penalty defendants to get a court hearing on evidence that they claim will show their innocence. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
In a case involving a prison killing, Lloyd Schlupe was convicted and sentenced to die. He appealed to the lower courts, claiming that he had new evidence of his innocence that had not been presented at his trial because of the incompetence of his lawyer and the state's withholding evidence. The lower courts, however, rejected his claim, citing a Supreme Court case that requires clear and convincing proof of innocence that no reasonable juror would reject in order to get a hearing on new evidence. But today, by a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court reversed the lower court. The justices said that in this case and some others where there has been a constitutional error committed during the course of a trial, a defendant need not show clear and convincing proof, but must only show that had the errors at trial not occurred, the jury would probably have found the defendant innocent. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
A strong aftershock was felt today in central Japan, registering 4.3 on the Richter scale. Remaining buildings swayed and glass broke, but there are no reports of more casualties. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is unchanged at 3,869. This is NPR. This Wednesday, the state of North Carolina will have its first Republican House speaker in nearly 100 years. From member station WFDD, Diane Bihar reports.
Republican Harold Brubaker will move up to the Speaker's podium from a seat in the back row of the House that he's occupied for 18 years. This is also the first time in 125 years that Republicans have held an outright majority in the House. The last time was in 1870 in what was known as the Carpetbagger Legislature. The GOP now controls at least 67 of 120 House seats and 23 of 50 seats in the state Senate. Because of recounts, new elections will be held to decide the winners of one seat in each chamber. For National Public Radio, I'm Diane Bihar in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
The Census Bureau says the American population is getting older and there are more of us. The Bureau has released a new report called How We're Changing. It says the number of Americans will increase from the current 261 million to 392 million by the year 2050. The report also predicts that Americans will live longer. Current life expectancy for the average American is a little more than 76 years. The report says that will increase to an average of 82 and a half years. The report also finds Americans earning less money. The Bureau says the median income for last year was a little more than $31,000. That's down 1% from 1992. The militant Islamic group Hezbollah says all six Israeli soldiers missing in Lebanon are dead. The group's political chief, Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, made the announcement yesterday, but Israel reiterates its belief at least one prisoner, Airman Ron Arad, is still alive. He was taken nearly 9 years ago. Sheikh Nasrallah made his statement while eulogizing a Hezbollah fighter who died in an Israeli-run prison in Lebanon. He blamed the West for seeking the six Israelis, but not caring about hundreds of Arab prisoners in the Israeli-run prison. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In 1990, the most notorious gang of hackers in cyberspace, the Masters of Deception, was caught. Several members were convicted and spent time in prison. A new book about the gang has just been published. It's called The Masters of Deception, The Gang That Ruled Cyberspace. It's written by my guests Michelle Slatala and Joshua Quitner. Slatala is a reporter for New York Newsday, and Quitner reports for Time magazine. Their book explores the rivalry between the Masters of Deception and another cyber gang called the Legion of Doom. In the second half of today's show, we'll hear from a member of the Masters of Deception, John Lee. An excerpt of Quitner and Slatala's new book appeared in the December issue of Wired magazine, and when the two returned home from their Thanksgiving vacation, they found strange things going on with their phone.
We got hacked, which was a great surprise to us. We returned home from my in-laws on Thanksgiving weekend and were surprised that we were getting no phone calls over a period of 2 days. Finally, late on Sunday night, I called my voicemail at Newsday, and there was this bizarre message from our new tenant, and she was very agitated and upset with us, and she was saying, "I really don't think you have a very funny sense of humor. I'm shocked that when I called and left you a message on your answering machine about an electrical problem in the house that Josh called me back and harassed me and made fun of me. I don't know if you have a very odd sense of humor or if Josh just gets really drunk all the time, but I don't appreciate it." So I hung up the phone and I was really ashen-faced, and Josh said, "What happened? Who died?" And I said, "I think we were hacked." And what happened when we were out of town was that computer hackers got into our New York Telephone phone account, or convinced a New York Telephone employee to make changes in our account and installed a feature called remote call forwarding. And so every person who tried to call us after that, the calls were forwarded to an answering machine out of state. And a voice answered the answering machine and said, "This is Josh Quitner," and then spewed obscenities and then said, "Leave a message," which is what our tenant had done. And one of the hackers had answered her call by calling her up and harassing her. As soon as we heard the message, we realized what had happened, because the whole hack closely resembled a hack that occurs in Chapter 3 of our book, Masters of Deception. And we called up the phone company and had them fix our phone. What was shocking to us was that all of our friends and relatives who had been trying to call us over the weekend had actually left messages on the machine.
Including my mother.
She heard her son spewing obscenities and then said, "Hi, this is your mother. How are the kids? Hope you got home all right."
So what do you know about who was behind it?
Well, we suspect that it's people who are affiliated with the Masters of Deception, if not outright former members of that group. John Lee actually was in touch with the people who did it, and has a copy of the messages that were left on the answering machine. And he says that his understanding is basically that this was done by people who didn't even want to see the name, much less the picture, of a member of another group called the Legion of Doom in the Wired article that ran that month.
My guests are Michelle Slatala and Joshua Quitner, authors of the new book, Masters of Deception, The Gang That Ruled Cyberspace. Your book is actually about two cyber gangs. What makes these groups gangs? Why do you call them gangs?
These were groups of teenage boys who hung out together, and they were drawn together by their common interest in computers, first and foremost, but using their computers to do things, to, in effect, trespass. And in each instance, they identified themselves as a gang or a crew by a common name. Now, that said, this doesn't mean that you've got 10 guys sitting in a room in front of one computer. Typically, their hacking forays were done alone in their own bedrooms throughout New York City and in other cases throughout the state of Texas. But often after making an attack on a system, they would call each other and trade notes, and their operations began to have more of a focused objective. They would all turn their attention on a particular target and try and get into it. And then once inside, they would try and set up an internal bulletin board, for instance, that would in effect be an online clubhouse where you could go and leave messages for each other and drop off files and hang out.
You call the Legion of Doom one of the gangs that you write about. You describe them as having been the most revered cyber gang. What were some of their most impressive acts?
Well, the Legion of Doom was really famous because initially they were expert dumpster divers. They used to like to go in the flesh to telephone companies and go through their garbage dumpsters at night, looking for technical manuals and passwords. And then would then take those manuals and technical bulletins and meticulously transcribe them into things that were called files. And you should note here that the word file in hacker speak is spelled P-H-I-L-E, not F-I-L-E, as a kind of homage to the telephone network. In any event, the files of the Legion of Doom were really what gave them their prestige in the underworld. They would drop arcane telephone company acronyms as if they were the native language that these guys spoke. Now, armed with this technical knowledge, an intelligent young hacker could do all sorts of things. If you knew how the telephone system operated, if you could climb inside one of the powerful switching computers that are the backbone of modern telephone networks, there was no limit to what you could do. You could create an unbillable telephone number for yourself. You could add all sorts of features to that number. You could turn the telephone of a rival into a payphone, so that when the poor kid's mom got on the phone to call Aunt Agnes down the block, she would hear an operator say, "Please deposit 25 cents."
Should I be speaking of the Legion of Doom in the past or present tense? Do they still exist?
The Legion of Doom, for all intents and purposes, is defunct. Typically what happens is, as these guys grow up and get girlfriends, they tend to pursue other interests.
Did the Legion of Doom have a code? A code about what was appropriate and what was inappropriate hacking?
I think in general, all hackers...
appropriate and inappropriate illegal activity. I know that sounds strange, but I mean, you know, maybe they did have a code.
I think in general, all hackers abide by a very simple code, which is simply, thou shalt not destroy. If you get inside of a system and you're looking around, don't change anything. Don't ruin anything. Don't crash the system.
And to that, I'd like to add, there was a corollary, and that's, thou shalt not make money. I mean, clearly, these were guys who had a high degree of technical expertise that could have been turned to all sorts of use. And there was sort of an unwritten rule that you don't make money off of what you know. You don't sell it. You don't use the knowledge that you've gained to make a buck. Now, we've started to see that change in some fairly dramatic ways, and you see that among the members, or a few of the members of the Masters of Deception.
My guests are Joshua Quitner and Michelle Slatala, co-authors of the new book Masters of Deception, The Gang That Ruled Cyberspace. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. We're talking about computer gangs with Michelle Slatala and Joshua Quittner. A feud between the Legion of Doom led to the formation of another cyber gang, the Masters of Deception. What happened?
Basically, one young New York hacker, a teenager named Mark Abeni, who lived in Queens, was one of the youngest members ever inducted into the Legion of Doom. There was some kind of internal falling out a few months later between Mark and a Legion of Doom member who lived in Texas, and Mark was essentially kicked out of the Legion of Doom. By that time, Mark had found a group of friends in New York, other hackers who spoke his language. When Mark was kicked out of the Legion of Doom, his new friends, kind of as a joke, said, "Well, we don't need the Legion of Doom, the LOD. We can start our own group, the MOD, the next iteration, and we'll call ourselves the Masters of Deception." It started as a joke, and for some of the members, probably Mark included, it remained more of a joke than a serious focused group that they were members of.
Until war broke out between the two gangs. What happened?
One day, one of the Masters of Deception named John Lee, an African-American from Brooklyn, was listening in on kind of a party line conference call where some of the Legion of Doom members were joking around with each other. And John, who had been listening silently for a while, broke into the call and said, "Yo, this is Corrupt from New York," in a very ethnic-sounding accent. He has the ability to mimic lots of different accents and voices. And someone from the Legion of Doom from Texas said onto the party line for everyone to hear, "Get that nigger off the line." And that hit John and the other Masters of Deception like a slap in the face. The way they perceived the incident was these rich or middle-class white kids, these homogenous kids from Texas, were making fun of them. The fact that they were a multiracial, multi-ethnic, I guess a gorgeous mosaic of New York's finest teenagers. And they basically decided that the Texas kids weren't going to get away with it.
So then the Masters of Deception declared war against the Legion of Doom. What did they do?
It was a phone network attack. They singled out the two ostensible leaders of the LOD, a guy named Eric Bloodaxe, that's his online handle, and another guy whose online handle was Doc Holliday. And at first it was constant phone calls at all hours of the night. It took a little bit of doing on the Masters of Deception's part because these guys in Texas all had unlisted phone numbers. But that, as it turned out, was not really difficult for them to hack. They were able to get the unlisted numbers of the Legion of Doom characters and call them, annoying them constantly. Sometimes they would call and one of the LOD guys would pick up the phone and he would find another LOD guy on there because they'd been bridged together. At this point, it was just annoying. It wasn't much more than that. On the other hand, it got worse. Eric Bloodaxe and Doc Holliday decided that they'd had it with the hacking world and they wanted to start their own sort of anti-hacker security firm. And they called it ComSec, for computer security. And they started it in Houston with some startup money from a wealthy Houston financier. And they tried to apply their skills to a number of large companies that were having problems with computer security. After all, who better than they would know what companies they were? Well, when John Lee and some of the others in MOD got wind of this, thanks to a story I think in Time magazine and another one in Newsweek, they decided that ComSec would be their new target of attack.
So the Masters of Deception launched an attack by this computer security agency that was founded by two guys from the rival gang, the Legion of Doom.
Right. The sort of seminal moment in that little battle was when Eric Bloodaxe was on a phone call with another famous hacker whose name was Craig Nydorf. And Craig and Eric Blood Axe were talking about some problems that Blood Axe had been having and that Craig had been having, and one of them said, "That sounds like something John Lee would do." And all of a sudden, another voice broke in and said, "Yeah, that does sound like something I would do." And it was John Lee, and he had figured out how to eavesdrop on this supposedly two-way call. Well, you can imagine, Blood Axe went through the roof at that, because here he's selling his skills as a computer security expert, and he can't even guarantee the privacy of his own telephone line.
Meanwhile, the FBI gets onto the case, and they bust the Masters of Deception. How did the FBI crack the case?
Actually, the case was cracked by two security investigators who worked for New York Telephone. They were the very first people to catch on to the fact that computer hackers were getting inside the phone system. Two guys named Tom Kaiser and Fred Staples, who put dial number recorders, little black boxes essentially, on the phone lines of the Masters of Deception. And the little black boxes kept track of every phone number that the kids dialed, every call that came into their house, the duration of the calls, and the time and date. And what the phone company investigators realized was that these kids were essentially making calls to private New York Telephone and AT&T and other phone company computers. They were calling them up and staying on the lines with their computers, talking to the phone company computers for hours at a time, basically getting inside the phone company computer systems and exploring. It's like going into a church and exploring the architecture inside the sanctuary.
But the problem that the telephone company investigators had was they could follow the calls into their own computers, but once they were inside, they didn't know where they went. It was pretty difficult for them to follow these kids around inside these powerful switching computers, and it terrified them. But now they're presented with a problem. Do they block access and not let these hackers in? But in doing so, they'd lose the hackers, A, and B, they wouldn't really know the extent of their own security flaws. Or do they leave the system open and attempt to follow them around in various kinds of sophisticated ways?
So what Kaiser and Staples did was to basically spy on the kids inside the system as much as possible. And at the same time, they called in the federal authorities, the Secret Service, which actually has jurisdiction over credit card fraud.
Telephone company investigators were on the case of the Masters of Deception. And then with the help of the Secret Service, they cracked it open. They found the guys, brought the guys to trial. The guys pled guilty. So what was the significance of this case in cyberspace?
This case sent a message. Up until this point, computer hackers all around the world, or at least in this country, believed that the phone company was asleep at the switch, and that if you were caught, if by some wild fluke you were caught browsing around in computer systems, you'd be given a slap on the wrist. Well, what this case said was the phone company is not asleep at the switch, and the criminal justice system is going to take these crimes very seriously. You will be caught, you will be prosecuted, and you will be sent to jail.
How were they sentenced?
Mark, all the kids got prison sentences except for one of the five who had agreed to testify against the others, and so he was given a suspended sentence. Mark was sentenced to a year in jail, Mark Abeni, Fiber Optic, and John Lee was also sentenced to a year in jail, too. A lot of people have problems with that. A lot of people believe that since this was not a crime that involved money, it was not a crime that involved violence, it was not a crime that involved individuals getting hurt, that jail was a pretty stringent thing to throw at these kids.
What specifically was the crime they were charged with?
They were charged with conspiracy and computer trespass and crimes that are connected to those two broad categories.
Against the phone company?
Against the phone companies, as well as against some of the most sensitive and powerful computer systems in the U.S. Everybody from Martin Marietta Missile Group to TRW uh, and and Bank of America were hit by these guys.
So what do you both think? You think the punishment fit the crime?
Well, we actually disagree about whether they committed a crime. I think that what they did was a crime and there should be laws against it. If basically these kids were to physically break into my house while I wasn't at home and walk around in all my rooms and look in my medicine cabinet and my underwear drawer and then leave without moving anything or destroying anything before I got home and I didn't know they were there, I would still feel like they had invaded my privacy and that it was illegal. That was essentially what these kids did to private computer systems.
The internet is still pretty young, and you know, we learn a little bit more every day about what it's capable of and what surprises it has in store for us. How worried are you about what computer outlaws and cyber gangs will be like in the future?
I don't believe that we have much to fear. I mean, I know that there is one gang that's out there now that calls itself the Posse, and I know that they've been collecting thousands and thousands of passwords. And I believe that there are investigative agencies that are hot on their trail. I don't really know what you could do with the passwords. At the moment, there isn't that much sensitive data that's out there. And companies that have sensitive data should be aware by now that if they're going to put their systems online, then they're going to have to make their systems secure. So the problem really resides with the company. For that reason, I think we're going to be okay.
Michelle?
That said, I think that hackers can sometimes unintentionally do harm. I mean, we talked about how the masters of deception really wanted just to get inside systems and look around them. There was one incident where unwittingly some members of the Masters of Deception crashed a public television station's computer network and brought it down. I think the implications for the future are that we're all going to worry a lot more in a generalized sense about a hacker menace. But when you try to quantify the harm that the menace does, you come up pretty empty-handed.
For instance, our book begins on Martin Luther King Day 5 years ago, and AT&T is suffering from the worst outage in its history. In fact, it still hasn't been surpassed. Half of all the calls that were placed that afternoon weren't completed because the network was falling apart. And Secret Service and law enforcement folks were racing around thinking, my God, did hackers do this? At the same time, in their apartments in Queens, Mark Abeni and Paul Styra are sitting there thinking, my God, did I do this? Because both of them, for the 6 months prior to that crash, have been fooling around in very sensitive AT&T routing computers. Well, it turns out that, no, they didn't do it. It was AT&T's problem. It was AT&T's fault. I would still argue that we have a lot more to fear from computer programmers, legitimate computer programmers, misprogramming their equipment and computers that don't work the way they should than computer hackers.
Joshua Quittner and Michelle Slatala are co-authors of Masters of Deception, The Gang That Ruled Cyberspace. We'll meet a former member of the Masters of Deception in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, what motivates a hacker to break into computer systems? We talk with John Lee, who is a member of the Masters of Deception, a gang of computer hackers. Lee was one of the members who did time for computer trespass. Also, world music critic Milo Miles reviews a new recording by Baba Mal of Senegal. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The defense in the O.J. Simpson double murder trial has submitted a last-minute list of 34 new witnesses it wants to call. The list came just hours before opening statements were supposed to begin. The prosecution says it should have time to interview these people before the trial starts. Judge Lance Ito has ruled 10 of the witnesses can be mentioned in the defense's opening statement, but he says the other 24 people can't be mentioned or called until the prosecution has had time to check them out. The prosecution is also raising concerns about a videotape that Simpson's defense wants to use during opening statements. Congress must now obey all workplace laws that private businesses have to. President Clinton has signed the Congressional Accountability Act. This extends 11 labor laws to Capitol Hill. The law is one of the items featured in the Republicans' Contract with America. The president says he hopes the new law is a sign of future change on Capitol Hill.
We must use this impetus to make much deeper changes in the culture of Washington that has too often disconnected it from ordinary Americans. The American people, for example, know that lobbyists frequently get access to Congress they can never hope to get. They know the voices of special interests still sometimes ring too loud. They know too much of what goes on here goes on behind closed doors.
President Clinton says the new law is something Democrats worked for during the last Congress, and he invited former House Speaker Tom Foley to watch today's signing ceremony. Anti-abortion activists are marking the 22nd anniversary of the Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion. They're holding rallies, demonstrations, and prayer vigils today. One of the largest events is the annual March for Life rally in Washington. Many activists are meeting with lawmakers. Abortion rights advocates are gathering, too. Israeli authorities are taking new security measures after yesterday's suicide bomb attack that killed 19 people. Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin's cabinet still wants to continue peace talks with the PLO, the BBC's Lise Doucette reports.
Yitzhak Rabin is under mounting pressure to take tougher steps to deal with this violence, but he and many others here admit it's extremely difficult to deter those willing to die in a determined campaign to undermine the peace process. The foreign minister, Shimon Peres, called suicide bombing another form of terror. But he told journalists here this violence didn't necessarily arise because of the peace process. Israel, he said, had dealt with this threat years ago in Lebanon. He said negotiations with the Palestinians would continue. But others in Mr. Rabin's cabinet have echoed the Israeli president's unprecedented call for a suspension of peace talks. For now, the government has approved a range of security measures. Security services are to step up their efforts to track down those responsible for this upsurge in violence.
This is NPR. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today. The Dow fell more than 2 points to end at 3,867. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 3-2 in heavy trading. A new Census Bureau study says that by the middle of the next century, one of every five Americans will be 65 or older. The study also says the U.S. population is getting larger. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The report predicts that in the coming century, people will live longer, with life expectancy rising from 76.3 years to an estimated 82.6 years. The nation's population of 261 million is expected to swell to 392 million by the year 2050. The study also found that the American workforce is earning less money. The Census Bureau says the median income for 1993 was just over $31,000, down 1% from the year before. Median household incomes declined 7% between 1989 and 1993. The Bureau says more people were living below the official poverty level of $14,000 for a family of four in 1993 than the previous year. The Bureau also finds that more fathers are taking a larger role in child care. As of 1991, fathers cared for 20% of preschoolers while mothers were at work. That's up from 15% in 1988. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
The Supreme Court has agreed to hear a case on the regulation of gambling on Indian reservations. The justices will decide whether federal courts have authority to oversee negotiations between the tribes and state officials on gambling operations. Federal appeals courts are split on the issue. A new Pacific storm is drenching Southern California. Authorities are reporting mudslides that stopped traffic. This comes after heavy rain earlier this month caused massive flooding and left several regions tagged disaster areas. Officials say the new storm is responsible for two deaths in San Diego County. Two people were killed when a cliff gave way beneath them. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What inspires a young computer wizard to use his skills to break into computer systems? My guest John Lee was a member of the Masters of Deception, a notorious gang of hackers. He's one of the people profiled in the new book, Masters of Deception, which we discussed in the first part of our show. Along with other members of his gang, he was convicted of conspiracy and computer trespass for breaking into computer systems. The authors of Masters of Deception write, "These boys were charged with the most widespread intrusions ever recorded of the nation's largest and most sensitive computer systems. The government decided to make an example of these teenagers." John Lee pled guilty, was sentenced to a year in prison, and served 6 months. Lee grew up in the inner-city neighborhood of Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn, New York, where he was once a member of a street gang. He claims to have broken into more than 25,000 computer systems. I asked him what he would do once he got in.
First of all, when I break into a system, we used to have, like, we kind of have, like, a mental checklist. Like, when you go into a system, first you, obviously, you rate its importance. You check out, you know, who owns the computer, what that company does. Then you go check, you know, what other companies are related to this company, and how could this, you know, computer, you know, what's up with this computer? And then, like, you might find out what other computers that this computer is, you know, connected to. And then you might go through the system and find stuff out. Now, if the system was something that I had never messed with before, obviously I'm not going to really... I never, like, damaged the system, but, like, there was two type of systems. Some of them you would just look at everything, and other ones you would just use to actually program, you know, because a lot of times I would program stuff when them, you know, because I didn't have access to, like, you know, expensive $1 million mainframes, mm-hmm. like a Cray or something like that. So, you know, I'd have to, like, borrow time to learn how to use them and program them, you know, maybe run a little program in the background, who's going to mind, you know, and, you know. And stuff like that. So it was definitely, you know, but there was other computers that we pretty much just looked at, absorbed the information that was in it, you know, just for curiosity's sake, and then just pretty much left it alone. Maybe every once in a while, we might tamper with something, and that would be to just, like, make sure we could always log in, and that would, like, be, you know, modify whatever, you know, modify it in a way that, you know, was invisible to all the users, so it wouldn't affect them in any way, but allowed us access always. And I'm sure that there's, like, you know, I'm sure there's, like, at least, like, 5,000 systems out there that probably are still, like, got those back doors in them, unfortunately.
Would you ever leave your mark just so people would know that you'd been there?
I personally never have done that, but I remember a couple of times we set up, like parasite bulletin boards sometimes on them. And they were basically like enclaves where, you know, it was like enclaves where people, you know, hackers would just get on there and stuff and, you know, talk and chat and stuff on, you know, on somebody else's computer. And the reason they would, you know, and it would just be cool because it'd be like such an accomplishment that you could do it. And, you know, sometimes we would, like, you know, break into, like, computers, like, here in the USA, and then maybe another one in England, and then maybe another one in South Africa. And then, like, network them, like, practice networking them and have, like, a network BBS from across the world and stuff like that, all on other people's computers. You know, stuff like that. And, you know, just cool, clever stuff, really. You know, but it depends on the computer because some computers obviously can help you hack into other computers. So it was kind of like your power used to grow exponentially because our power base grew exponentially after we took over every single regional Bell operating company in the country. because at that point we could monitor any phone line in the country, and basically there was no need for hacking at that point because you can see everything.
Did you have a personal code about what kind of breaking in was acceptable and what wasn't?
Yep. I felt that that like any computer was fair game, and I felt that hacking was illegal. However, it was just that I was just really good at it. But there was some limits, and one of the limits was like credit fraud and like toll fraud. I tried to avoid those things at all costs. I did avoid credit fraud. I never really, because I felt as we moved toward a creditless society, I mean a moneyless society, and you know that's based on credit. You know, there's a lot of services that are offered with that, and a lot of those services wouldn't be available if the credit, if credit was undermined. And you know, by doing, you know, damaging other people's credit is usually the small guy that gets hurt. You know, the average person, you know, like even like somebody like my mom could get, you know, affected by credit fraud and have to shell out bucks. So that's why I always stayed away from those sort of things. But like just the pure, you know, challenge of breaking into computer systems and learning how to program them and operating them, you know, to their full capacity is was stimulating.
How did you learn about computers?
Oh, I learned about computers because I got lucky. Because my mom's is a school teacher, and she had a friend there who was into computers, like had an old Apple. And, you know, when I would come there after school, she would let me play with it and touch it and, you know, mess with it. It was kind of clever.
So how old were you when you got your own computer?
It's kind of way back, but I think it was like around 12, maybe. Maybe a little bit. Yeah, 12. 12. I did get a Commodore 64 at 12.
How did you cobble together enough sophisticated equipment to become a hacker?
Well, the funny thing is that you don't need sophisticated equipment. You only need a dumb terminal. You just need a monitor and a keyboard and a modem, which doesn't require like a hard drive or anything like that. Because when in the beginning, I never had those things. And then when I did have enough money to get them, I didn't need them because all I did was really like hack and stuff. So you don't really need sophisticated equipment. You can get a dumb terminal from Radio Shack for like maybe $10 and then a follow up a modem for maybe another couple of bucks, and then you're straight.
Now, I read about you that you actually like scavenged a lot of equipment.
Oh, yeah, sure.
How'd you find it? Where would you go?
I mean, sometimes you'd see it thrown out from like telephone companies and universities and stuff, or sometimes, you know, someone would sell something for really cheap. You might buy it. But most of the time, you know, you can scrounge it up and they're like throwing it out and they don't realize that they could possibly fix it. I know that there's like several companies now that do stuff to, you know, they ask corporations for those computers they're going to throw out and refurbish them. And, you know, I guess they give them to schools and stuff like that.
My guest is John Lee. He used to be a member of a gang of computer hackers called Masters of Deception. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with former computer hacker John Lee. Can you tell me about the first time that you actually broke into a computer system? How you got in, what it felt like to you?
That's a good feeling. I remember the first time I dropped in after breaking into a system. It felt so good. It was sort of like a real good back rub, like on the verge of like orgasmic pleasure. I don't know how to explain it. It was like a tingly feeling all over. And, well, I hope nobody else gets addicted. It's very addictive because it's funny. The first time it's like that. I did get numb all over. And, you know, and of course it was almost like a drug because eventually as I broke into computers, you know, I kept searching for new highs, you know, more challenging computers. So I had to, you know, eventually just try to break into everything, looking for that magic high of the first time.
Now, how did you find other hackers?
most of the time, sometimes you'd meet them in the weirdest places, you know. You would just be, like, somewhere, you know, messing with a computer, and, you know, they'd come along, and, you know, you'd talk, and then eventually, you know, you'd find out, you know, like, kind of how, you know, they felt about certain issues, and then next thing you know, you probably reveal your identities to each other. And then, you know, there's other situations where I've run into computer hackers on, like, systems. Like, I remember one time I met this kid on a system from Japan, and he was, like, a hacker, and he had, like, never met any other computer hackers. And, like, you know, he was like, Japanese, and he was, like, kicking it and stuff, and he was mad cool, and he was pretty good, too. And, you know, became friends and stuff like that, and strictly met on, like, this system that we had both hacked, you know?
You were in the Masters of Deception.
This is true.
A gang in cyberspace. Did you know each other only from speaking online, or did you meet together geographically, too?
At first, we just used to meet online. Then eventually, we met in person. I mean, we met in so many. It's hard to say because we met in so many different ways, like just overlapping. Like I remember, I had changed high schools, and so did fiber optic Mark Abene, and we wound up at the same alternative high school in Manhattan. And it was just, you know, complete. I mean, that was just complete. You know, who could imagine that we would just meet like that? You know. And then, but I had met him before that. It's just that I had never met him in person. And of course, then we became like friends and stuff at the time.
You were busted by the Secret Service with the help of telephone company investigators. Did you expect that you would eventually be discovered?
Well, the funny thing is we knew that they were coming for like months on end. Due to, like, secret documents that they provided for us, you know? Well, they didn't know they were providing them, but we knew. But it was like, you know, it was like I had to make a... We all had to make a decision whether, you know, we wanted to do this for the rest of our lives. Did we want to go on the run and just do this forever? Or did, you know, never see, like, my moms again or something like that? Or should we just sit there and wait for them to come? And, you know, obviously the decision was made to just say, well, you know, they're coming, so.
So you pled guilty.
Mm-hmm.
You were, correct me if I'm wrong, you were sentenced to a year, spent 6 months in prison.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like in prison?
Well, I went to boot camp, so it was kind of, you know, like, you know, that paramilitary stuff, you know. I was like squad leader, like I was team leader, so, you know, I got to march everybody around. Oh, team! So it was kind of clever, but we had no TV and no newspapers and...
No computers, probably.
No computers.
Do you feel like you were changed by the prison experience?
No, because I'd already changed before I went in. Because, like, with most federal cases, a lot of times you actually don't go to jail for the crime till like, a couple of years later. Like, in this case, it was, like, 2 years later. And, like, I had enrolled... I was in college and had done, like, tons of community service stuff, not because of the case, but just because I was doing it and just like doing like positive stuff. And then I got yanked to jail. That happened to all of us, actually. We all had started to do positive stuff and then we got sentenced. And I don't think the judge took that into account. He just said, yo, you guys got to go.
So you've served time for doing something illegal, but the thing that you did that was illegal, you were able to do because you're really gifted and really smart about computers. So when you're, say, in the job market or something, and I'm not sure if you have been or not, but I wonder what the balance is of scorn that you get because you did something illegal and praise and interest because you're obviously really gifted.
After I got busted, but before I got sentenced, you know, I went for a computer job interview and I'd fill out they'd have like a little exam and the guy would come back and he would say, you know, you scored better than guys who've come in here with like 20 years experience or like master's degrees in computer science. And he'd say, but guess what? You don't even have a degree or anything. I can't give you this job. I just can't, you know, pass this through personnel. There's no way they're going to hire you, even though I'll give you my full recommendation. I wouldn't get hired, you know. And these were like $50,000 jobs and stuff. And, you know, I mean, I even tried before I got busted. And, you know, they kind of like, you know, they kind of like acted funny and stuff. So, you know, because I think they kind of figured that we were probably, you know, between our age and no degree, they probably figured that we were hackers or something like that. I'm not sure. But that happened. And then recently now when I go on, like, I do, like, lecturing and stuff like that about computer hacking, and I might go somewhere to, like, a company, and they never let me near their computers. I went to, like, some company, like, refuse to let me, like, even in the room with them. They don't want me to see anything. And some people might think it's flattering, but I kind of think it's insulting to think that, you know, even to today, that just me being in a room, that I would try to do something.
Do you ever get harassed online now?
Who, me? Mm-hmm. Why? I don't understand. Why would I get harassed?
I don't know. I thought maybe there are people who still feel they have debts to pay.
I think I guess the Master Deception, we've reached a certain level of respect that, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, someone won't come along better than us or anything like that. But like I said, I don't think anybody can really touch what we've done. Like, the Master Deception and, like, Deepak will rule forever. Like, it's like a legend type thing. And, you know, I mean, it's a grudging respect, I admit, from even our enemies, like maybe like some of the enemies we've made in the past. But, you know, I'd like to say, you know, I'm sorry.
Do you still see the people who are in the Masters of Deception?
Well, legally, we're not supposed to see or talk to each other. So I guess that precludes any sort of meeting.
John Lee is a former member of the computer hacker gang Masters of Deception. He's one of the people profiled in the new book, Masters of Deception. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have on the aftermath of the suicide bombing in Israel?
Well, we'll be hearing from NPR's Linda Gradstein about the, among other things, the address of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin to the Israeli people, in which he called for continuing of the peace process with the PLO, with an eye toward the total separation of the Palestinian and Israeli people. We'll also be hearing some reaction to this from the those in both Israel and among the Palestinians who oppose that relationship. We'll hear from the leader of the Israeli Likud party and also a spokesman for the Muslim movement Hamas in Gaza. And also on today's program, Melissa Block with some history of the death penalty in New York State.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Senegalese singer Baba Maal is currently on tour in the U.S. Music critic Milo Miles recommends you go see him. If that's not possible, Milo says, listen to his new record.
For a long time, Baba Maal has been my candidate for the Afropop performer most deserving a break with the American audience. Maal's fundamental problem is that his countryman Youssou N'Dour gets all the attention. But Maal is at least as inventive and variously talented, if less golden-throated. Maal has recorded one meditative masterpiece, Jam Lili, which featured his childhood friend Mansour Sek on guitar. That was released here in 1989, and Maal has had rough sailing since then. His next record was also largely acoustic, but much more lackluster and meandering. Then he came up with a sparkling album that featured his electric band, Dande Lanol. It was ruined by an American remix that managed to be both New Age sappy and disco harsh. Now he's finally done it, made an album that lives up to the swirling high spirits and passionate laments of his live shows. It's called Fire and Fota, and it's one of the finest world music records of 1994.
Of my land, of the world.
What does Firon and Fota mean? Well, Fota is Mal's home territory in North Senegal, where he is a member of the minority language speakers. Mal learned to play many instruments, though he did not come from the musician caste. He studied both law and art in Dakar and Paris. It seems to me that no matter how amplified his sound, Mal is essentially a folky. His source material is invariably old songs and forms from rural areas. But Mal's curiosity ranges all over, and his sense of how to knit the past and present together is bold, even wild. One of the chief pleasures of his work is that you sense the Africa he knows in it. This is a place getting poorer, groping for unity and heroes. Mal acknowledges the sorrows of poverty in numbers like Njelu, but he fights his way to an upbeat finale. His job is to inspire the audience as an optimist, a builder, a down-home sage. Whether or not Mal finds his bigger audience, he and producer Simon Emerson have found the right tone for a cosmopolitan African pop record. Firon and Fota uses an army of hired musicians, including a fat horn section and the London Session Orchestra, but Mal commands everything with his high Islamic tenor. The forceful articulation of each track, the mix of sobriety and celebration, reminds me of durable rock and roll LPs. Play Firon and Fota after Bob Dylan's Bringing It All Back Home or Bruce Springsteen's The River, and you will hear a kindred smart soul.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. He reviewed Baba Mal's new record, Firon and Fota, on Mango Records. Baba Mal is in this country through February 5th, with stops in Washington, D.C., Cambridge, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland, and Seattle. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.